Well, as you're probably aware, the book of Judges actually covers a 450-year period of time. The children of Israel, of course, were brought out of Egypt by Moses into the wilderness, and then Joshua picked things up, brought them out of the wilderness and into the promised land. Then as he brought them in, ultimately Joshua did what they called the divide and conquer, where the land was then, of the promised land, was divided up into 12 parcels, with each one of the children or the 12 tribes of Israel, you know, by lot, was to take one area of it and to go and divide and conquer it, to take it. And then perhaps to help one another as the battles would be there to help them through it. Well, they got into the land, but they were warned over and over and over again. Many times the Lord reminded them, now when you get in there, there's all these gods and goddesses, there's all these idols and all these images that these enemies have, that these other nations, the Philistines, the Moabites, Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, Jeshurites, the Amalekites, all of them, one after another, they all have these things, but they all came down essentially the same category of things. There was whether, Moloch or Baal or Ashtaroth, whether it was the goddesses of material or sensual or power, the same things that the world has always loved, power, money, sex, you know, the sensual world, the things that distract and destroy lives. And he told them, when you get in, don't worship these. They'll destroy you. You keep me in your heart, your life. You worship me, and I will care for you. I'll give you the land. I'll give you, you know, right now, he says, I've just left these all in the land, so you don't have to go in and take all, you know, barren land. You'll just, as you just go in, they've already built the house. They've already dug the wells. They've got olivers and vineyards that you'll take all this. The houses will even have utensil in them. You'll have oxen and sheep and oxen. You'll just move in out of, your struggles into blessing. As you trust me, and then you drive them out, I will go before you. You keep your heart and your life right with me. I will provide all of these things for you. Simple enough. But also, he says, but if you turn away from me, I will turn you over to your enemy. And if you want to follow their gods and goddesses, then you will suffer the consequences of what those gods and goddesses can do to a human being and to their homes and marriages and families. Well, they got in, and the next thing you know, they would, over and over, they were attracted and distracted by these gods and goddesses. Sometimes we tend to look at these, what we remember as statues and images, and these things, and wonder, well, why would that stumble people? Why would they go after that? But if you understand, it's almost like the children of Israel, if you could imagine growing up in the, you know, in the deserts of Nevada, and you know, on one hand, the Lord provided for them, took care of them, and he fed them, and their clothes didn't wear out, their shoes didn't wear out. Here, could you imagine, though, at the same time, you imagine some of you ladies would be tormented, the idea of only having one pair of shoes for 40 years. We won't go there with that. But anyway, think I'm ready for a new outfit. You know, anyway, they come in. But if you can imagine, put it in this perspective, you're out in the desert, so in Nevada, and finally you're going into the land, and you come over a hill, and then you look down at night, and you see all these lights. What in the world is that? It's just in the dark of the night, but this bright lights. If you've ever flown across the country at nighttime, and you see as it's barren and dark everywhere at nighttime, but then you'll see the cities where they are, lights here, and then you'll go on in another big city, lights here, and you know, light up, you know, the horizon as you're flying across. But here you come across, you see Nevada. I mean, you're coming out, and all of a sudden there's Las Vegas. You look, what in the world is that? There's this light, right? And then you get close and you walk down the streets. And next thing you know, as you walk down the streets, you see, I mean, these women that are just gorgeous, their hair, phenomenal, the jewelry, the clothing, outfits. You know, you see the men all decked out. You see their stuff. You see their lights. You see their party. You see the shows that go on. You see all of these things, and you think, well, this can't all be bad. You know, what do you mean? You know, and the next thing you know, I mean, all of a sudden here you are, you feel unattractive and kind of scruffy, and you look, boy, look at these, you know, these women, whatever they do to themselves, however they pull off this beauty stuff, it's working pretty good for them. And then you, next thing you know, well, look at these men, look at the stuff they've got, look at the material, look at, boy, they walk around with a sense of success, you know, and things, boy, they, and next thing you know, you're looking at these things and easily thinking, well, it can't be that bad. And so you start messing with it. And next thing you know, you've taken your eyes off the Lord, His presence, His power, His sufficiency, and you're finding your sufficiency in these other things. You find yourself drawn to them in a way you don't need the Lord so desperately any longer. After all, you're succeeding. Look at what you're acquiring. Look at what's coming your way. But little by little, next thing you know, the relationship suffers, the tensions in the marriage, the children, the attractions and distractions from one another, and things crumble around you, and you realize you've lost His presence. And you begin to pay a terrible price. Well, the book of Judges, that same thing happened repeatedly, over and over again. Actually, some 47 years before we look here in this story with Gideon, Deborah, the prophetess, provided the inspiration to Barak, and Deborah and Barak, they're under their leadership, Israel, there fought off a great oppression, and that was, you know, almost 50 years ago, and they had a great victory, revival came, they broke out, but here now they are. Where now the Midianites, they turned away from the Lord. The Midianites have come in, and for the last 7 years, they just come in. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and other nations from the east, they would wait for the children of Israel, go plow your fields, go grow your crops, go let your herds and flocks replenish and grow. And then they would wait until, okay, now it's time. They're beginning to bring in the crops. And it's already there. The harvest is done. The animals have come. Now they would just wait like they walked into a grocery store and rob it. Okay, everything's on the shelves, ready to go. And year after year, they'd work like everything. And the next thing you know, they're just getting worse and worse and worse. They're hiding now in caves and in dens. And they're, just wondering what in the world is wrong with their lives, until finally we're told the children of Israel cry out to the Lord. And when they cry out to Him, He said, I'm going to send you a leader and get you out of this. And so here, we're introduced, of all people, to Gideon. And here he is. He is of the tribe of Manasseh. And there he is, as the angel comes to him and he greets him, calls him a mighty man of valor. Here you've got a guy at night hiding from the Midianites, grinding out some wheat there's for a loaf of bread. So, hoping he's not seen, scared to death. All of a sudden, an angel appears to him and calls him a mighty man of valor. And he said, what are you talking about? And he says, oh, here, we're going to get out of this thing. You're going to lead the children of Israel into a blessing. And he said, I don't know who you are. I don't know who you think you're talking to. But let me tell you who you're talking to. I am of the tribe of Manasseh, the least of the tribes when it comes to warriors. We're not it. We're not warriors. And then my family is the least of the tribe, and I happen to be the least of my family. Hello, I'm the least of the least of the least. You got the wrong Gideon, I can assure you. He says, no, I don't. No, I don't. I've got the right one. I know who I'm looking for. I know who I've got. And, we're gonna get this thing done. And you're just the one. So, get ready for it. And he's there. He says, there's no way this could possibly be it. There's somebody else, somewhere else, something. But the angel, he persists. And so Gideon says, well, look, here's the deal. Gideon, obviously insecure. I'm the least, obviously fearful. And then when he even tells him we're going to do this, he says, wait a minute. I grew up hearing these stories, how powerful God was, the things God did, the miracles He brought. What happened? Where is He? They're just stories now. But here as he comes, he says, how can I save them? But then he speaks to him. And he said, no, you're it. And so Gideon says, can I check you out a little? Well, you know what? He said, just stay here. He goes and he gets an offering. He brings the offering back And the angel had, well, just put it over there on this rock. Puts it on a rock, he takes his staff, and just like that, he smokes it. Boom. Consumes it. He looks there. It's gone. And he realizes, oh no, maybe this is God. Maybe he is talking to me. Which I think even made it worse in one sense. It was all right when I didn't believe he could actually be potentially talking to me. Why would he take any time of all the other people in the whole world to talk to? I can assure you it's not me. Now he's troubled because it might be him. But why me? Why would you talk to me? I'm the least of anybody. And you know, that's so often the way God works. He picks and he talks to somebody that just feels this is the weirdest thing that could ever possibly happen. And then, I mean, with all that's going on in the world, all that's going on everywhere else, all the problems with all these other nations, with the Midianites, the Amalekites, all the other kings, all the things that are going on everywhere, and now you're talking to me, telling you want to use me to do something. He said, this can't be true. And so then he says, well, let's test it out. He tests it out. He smokes the offering there, and he realizes, all right, something's going on here. I don't know what it is. But then, now the angel tells him, okay, here, you know, when Gideon's probably, well, what do you want me to do? What can I do about all this? What could I even think of the Midianites? 120,000 of them down there in the valley. And you're talking to me, I'm hiding out in a wine press. So they were doing it at night, so they didn't see me. What in the world could I possibly do? And then he tells him, he says, well, I want you to go home. And I, you know, your father's built, you know, these images. They've got their altar there to Baal, he tells them in chapter 6, verse 25. An image there of a Canaanite goddess. Here, you know, Ashtaroth, Baal, the gods and goddesses of power and of pleasure and materialism. And there that they had brought into their own hearts and lives, even though they've lost everything, they're still kind of having these images. They've been robbed of everything, but they're still thinking material. They're still thinking stuff. They're still worshiping. We gotta get our crops back. We've got to get our stuff back. And they're looking as things gone down, 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 down. They still have in their heart a material thought of hope. And also a sensual one, the goddess Ashtaroth, these pleasures. And he says, I want you to go home and tear these down. And then I want you to build an altar to me next to it. Well, what's that have to do with the world? Your business isn't the world, Gideon, right now. Your business is your world. Your business there is under your own roof. I want you to go home and deal with your own heart, your own life, your own circumstances that are going on. Well, Gideon, bless his heart, he goes home and he does it. He does it by night for fear of the men of the city. He didn't want to be seen. He didn't want to, so he hides, does it there under darkness, and he does it there. So, I mean, he's afraid now of his family. He's afraid of the men of the city. He's afraid of what's the world is going on, everything. But amazingly, he does it. Gets rid of it. And then he builds an altar to the Lord. They wake up the next day, and now they're all looking around. Hey, where did our gods and goddesses go? Where did these images go? This is the things that we need to survive, that we worship, that we need to, our material is gone. We got to get more material, our pleasures and sensual aspects of our lives. What's going on here? We need it. And here all of a sudden now they've got an altar to a God that I haven't thought about in many years and was little more than a rumor. Here he looks back now 47 years after the previous spiritual revival. You know, and now all of them are looking around Gideon saying, yeah, I heard stuff. Oh yeah, our parents told us these great stories of what God did. I don't see it. And you know, it's funny. It's like 50 years ago. You know, I got saved in the mid-60s. And at the time, it's interesting, the world was in chaos then, for those of you that are alive around. You remember, there was Vietnam. There was all this political unrest. There was marching in the street. There was all the peace, and freedom stuff. You know, there was student, you know, we're taking, you know, SDA, the Students for Democratic Action. There was all of the racial things. There was Martin Luther King. There was the, you know, the SDA. There was the Black Panthers. There was drugs and alcohol. There was all sorts of corruption everywhere, you know, on campuses. In taking over government offices with these big sit-ins, and Vietnam, Watergate, I mean, all the whole system, the world, Soviet Union, Khrushchev, all these things, people are looking around. And but somehow or another, in the midst of that, people began not to look at a political answer or an answer of power. They began to cry out to God. And God gave us a revival. I was one of the products of that. At that time, Billy Graham exploded. Campus Crusade for Christ exploded. Young Life exploded. The Baptists were exploding. The Methodists were growing. The Presbyterians were growing. The Charismatic Catholics were growing. Anybody that was remotely preaching Christ, they were exploding. The people were running and realized the world's in trouble, and our world is in trouble, and our kids are in trouble, and drugs are terrible, and the political system is so corrupt everywhere you look at it. Who can you trust anywhere? You know, and here, you know, with you know, Kennedy had had the thing of with Cuba and all of the things going on, and it's like they'd lost hope in everything. But they began to cry out to God, and God gave us a visitation. And a wonderful thing happened. Some of you were the product of that. Now a generation has gone by. Now our kids maybe are saying, oh, you know, we remember you guys talking about these creative things. Where is it? I don't see any miracles. The world's worse off than it ever was. And what's happening? Nothing. Where's God? I don't even know if I believe in him. You want to believe in him? That's up to you. But I don't see any evidence of it. And yet God says to us, now I want you to go home. What do you want me to do about it? I want you to go home. What do? He said, I want you to clean up what you can. I'm not asking you to clean up the planet. I'm not asking you to go to Russia, Ukraine, North Korea. I'm not asking you to answer China or Taiwan. I'm asking you, there's a bigger battle than that for you. Your own home, the altars, the things that have been built up little by little over time, tear them down. The desire for all the world here and the success of the world and the sensual things. You know, you've got different things in your house and under your roof and things that you watch on cable TV or whatever else. Pull the plug. You got vocabulary and behavior you use. You got tempers you let flare. You see yourselves out of control under your own roof. Things that don't bring glory to God. You can deal with that. It's as big as anything in the world. Deal with yours. I remember, you know, and sometimes it's tough. When many years ago, one time, my boys are now, I have three of them, they run from 46 to 51 years old. And but one time, I look into one of my boys' rooms, and in there, there's a big poster of a cheerleader. I think it was a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader, but one of those. You know how they're all kind of, you know, the cheerleaders for the football teams are, how they're dressed and all thing. Well, there's a big poster of one of them. And I walked by that, I don't approve of that. What am I going to do with it? And I thought about it for a minute or two. I took it off the wall. I went and I hung it up in the living room. And waited. Well, sure enough, my boy comes home, he walks by, he sees this picture of this Dallas Cowboy in the living room. He says, that's my poster. What's that doing there? I said, I'll tell you, it's funny. I saw that. And I thought, you know something? She was such a pretty girl that I thought everybody that comes in our house should notice how attractive she is. Don't you think that's a good idea? And you know, you could see right on his face the very moment of that, he knew it wasn't right. Had a sense to realize there that what he could have maybe in his own little world and off tucked off, maybe other people wouldn't approve, maybe it's not whatever they want to think, but this is my room, I'm going to do what I want to with my room, which I also had to clear up. And I said, by the way, that's not your room. What do you mean it's not my room? No, it's my room. Now, I'm willing to sell it to you for about $15,000 if you would like to buy your portion that you have, or I will work out lease agreements on it. But no, otherwise, that's my room that I allow you to sleep in until I throw you out for the last time. You know, or no? No, I wasn't. Well, I didn't say that part, but I mean, I made it very clear. I have an accountability to God for what's under my roof and what's in my home. And we're going to deal with it. And you know, when that sometimes that is very tough. It can be very confrontive. The things that go on and the behavior that goes on and the vocabulary that happens and the desires and the things that somebody watch. But there God says, if you can deal with your world, you can be part of dealing with the world. But God says you start there. Start there, you know, when there's something there. As much as we hate the corruption that's all over the rest of the world that's going on, when we go home and say, God, is there any corruption here? And oh, that's when the battle. But here, you know, Gideon, bless his heart, he's so much like all the rest of us. He's afraid. I don't know, you know, doing that, he struggles with the whole thing, but he does it. And then after he does it, sure enough, the men of the city, they wake up, they look around, who did this? Gideon's son. He's going to die. Are you kidding me? He's killing him. Then Gideon's father actually stands up for him and he says, hey, but we all knew this was wrong all along. If their gods let them defend themselves, well, they backed off. But there's something there here, Gideon, he's still struggling, he's still afraid. God, I don't know what's next, what do you want? And he says, I mean, what's the plan? And he's so afraid, he says, God, I need you to help me with something. I'm not sure it's you, sorry. But I'd like to take an animal skin, a fleece. I want to take it and I want to put it out tonight, and I would like you, your God, you can do anything. I'd like you to, tomorrow morning, that the fleece is sopping wet. And the land, the dirt all around it is dry. So I know it's you. God says, okay, see you in the morning. He wakes up in the morning, picks up the fleece, wrings it out, fills up a bowl with water, and it's dry around. Oh, great. He wasn't prepared for that. He backs off. He said, now, God, I don't want to push this thing. Please be patient with me and things. He says, but look, can we do a reverse fleece? Could we have it wet all around and the fleece be dry? God says, okay. Good night. See you in the morning. Comes out next morning. Here it is, all wet around and the fleece is dry. And here he still is struggling. He's still afraid there of, you know, what's going on and what to do. Oh, isn't it wonderful how patient God is with us? All through our lives, he tells us things. We know them and we struggle with them and we go back and forth on them. And yet God, he understands our struggles. He understands our fears. But when there's somebody that's truly seeking his will, he's amazingly patient. And all the way through this whole process, the entire process, one of the fundamental things that's going on here is Gideon and his fears. Even after he goes and he gets the army and they get ready, and it's the night before the battle that's now going to go on with the 120,000 enemies down in the valley, God comes to Gideon and he sees him. He's still afraid. And God says to him, Gideon, if you're still afraid, take Purah, your servant, go down into the camp, enemy of the camp, and see what they have to say. See what they're thinking about this. Which wasn't a hard thing to do in a sense. Here's the Amalekites, the Midianites, and other kings from the east. And so they're all different languages, all different dress, you know, and identities and all around. It'd be easy to walk into something like that, 120,000, and just kind of walk through. Well, so they do. Which means what? He was afraid. He said, if you're afraid, go down. So he goes down. And then when he gets down there, they come across some guys sitting there talking, and one of them just says, oh man, I just had the most terrible thing. Well, what's this? Well, this huge bread loaf comes down out of the mountain, crashes into the tent, chaos breaks out. And here, another guy, he looks at him, he says, oh no. He says, you know what this is? This is the sword of Gideon. We're done for. And Gideon and Purah hear this, and Gideon's all excited. He goes running back and he says, the Lord's going to deliver them into our hand. It's going to happen. And you know, this is kind of an amazing thing. Over and over and over again, God, you know, tries to convince Gideon, I'm with you. I'm going to give you everything you need. I'm there. I'm God. Trust me. And he's afraid and afraid and afraid, struggles with everything until finally God says to him, all right, If you're still afraid and you don't trust me yet, go down and listen to the enemy. So he goes down. The enemy says what God has been telling him all along, and he rejoices. He's excited. God's going to deliver my hand. How do you know? The enemy told me so. You know, obviously I'm not God, but I sometimes wonder, if you're God, would you deal with some of the things we humans are? You know, I would sit there and I would seriously seek some form of therapy. I would seriously want to just kind of go and lay down before a good psychiatrist and just say, I need some help. I love these people. I'm God. I'm powerful. I create the world. I speak something into existence, out of existence. I'm really good at it. And yet, I go to talk to them, and they won't believe me. You know, and I tell them, you know, I call him a mighty man, who doesn't believe me. I have him get a little sacrifice, boom, smoke it. You know, there. Does he believe me? No, still afraid. Then he needs, a fleece. And so he put water on a fleece, so I put water on the fleece and keep it dry. Boom, does it? No, does he believe me? No. Then it's dry, on the fleece and wet there. I do that. No, does he believe me? No. No matter what I do, he doesn't believe me. You know, do you think it's my delivery? Maybe when I say, Gideon, you mighty man of valor. Is it the tone of my voice? Is it the way I smoke the thing? Should I have smoked this sacrifice a little different? Where am I missing out? Help me in my communication skills with people, or something. And then the enemy comes and whispers something in their ear, and they're excited. I got a problem. How many times does God tell us and tell us and tell us, I'll be with you. I'll go home with you. I'll help you. We'll deal with this. Nah. And we're afraid. But here, finally, Gideon, as he kind of goes through these things with God, with his amazing patience, dealing with us, growing us, seeing how human we are and seeing our fears and all of our struggles. But then finally, Gideon, as he's ready to kind of do this, he blows the trumpet, calls the armies, the men together for war. And then they show up in the hundreds, and then they show up in the thousands, and then they get up to 32,000, and no more coming. I mean, first, boy, this is great. Look at this. They're coming in. And then the next thing 32,000. Nobody else is coming. There's 120,000 down the valley. We're outnumbered basically 4-1. And you hear Gideon, oh, wow. These guys are, this can't work. Something's wrong with this thing. And, of course, the Lord responds to this thing, and he says, yeah, you're right. The odds are not right at all. Oh, good. What's the answer? You got to go to your men, and I want you to talk to them, and I want you to tell the 32,000, if there's any that are trembling and they are afraid, that they can go home. There's something, they have 120,000. They're the ones that need to go home, not our 32,000. No, we got that right. He said, because you see, you have this incredible capacity, even when the odds are against you, if you really go at something and you succeed, you will think you did it and not me. So I got to get it down to where the odds are realization. You can't have it. You know, it's interesting. We look at the world today of what's going on. Nobody can miss, what's going on right now with Russia. And here you look at this little country, somebody they could just snuff under, you would think, and everybody else in the world has thought in a moment they could just wipe them out. They could bring them to their knees. And next thing you know, boy, they're standing up. They're fighting it. And they're heroes. They're standing in front of tents. They're going on saying, we're not leaving. I don't want a trip out of here, a free trip out of here. We want ammo. We need this. We need that. And the world is looking at them as heroes. But at the same time, there's no cry for God. And if they do, who knows what's going to happen. I don't know any more than anybody else. But if somehow or another they seem to win this, they will fill the streets and think we did it. The world will applaud them. Look at what you did. Because there was never a cry for God. And, we're not hearing of it if there is. We're not seeing any of our leaders anywhere calling the world to prayer or seeing these things happening in great movements of spiritual or hunger like this. We're just seeing men there kind of playing chess with each other. All right, you do this, we'll do this. We'll counter that with that. One nation over here, okay, NATO, you're going to do this. All right, Finland, don't worry about it. We might bring you into NATO. And okay, what's going on over here in the Baltics? And then, okay, Germany, you've got to get in on this thing, because if you don't get in, all right, Germany says, all right, we're in. But you look at all of the things there that men are talking to men, they're talking to men, they're talking to men, they're talking to men. Each men, man, and country talking to one another. What are we going to do? What are you going to do? Well, let's do this. All right, we'll counter this. You know, I don't know what will happen anymore, anybody else. But we don't see a cry. We see something there where it's like the Lord is just saying, all right, you think you're going to figure it out. And now this morning, you know, one man, one stands up, tells his nuclear arsenal, get ready. And now the world's watching there as he moves his next move on the chessboard here. Checkmate for somebody. What are you going to do now? And now, you know, as everybody else, what are they doing? What are we going to ever look into their leaders? You know, and whether it's somebody's home, whether it's the little community, when we look at all of these things to realize that there is still something God looks, he says, you are looking to your own sufficiency. You're still looking whether you got 32,000 or you're down to 10,000 or whatever it is, but you're going down to where you realize it's me. And whatever it is you have because I gave it to you. That's what the Bible says. Paul says, what does a man have that he hasn't received it from God? And if he's received it from God, why does he think that he hasn't? Everything you have, everything there is, God gave it to us. And to credit him for it, and to bow and show him reverence. And so Gideon, he goes to them and he says, all right, any of you that are afraid, you're trembling, you may go home. Imagine when God told Gideon, tell them if they're afraid, then again, they can go home. Gideon probably thought, that'd be me too. Yeah, I'm going. But he didn't. But there's 22,000 there that are sick and tired of the oppression. 22,000 that hate the evil. 22,000 that they can't stand the wickedness of it. 22,000 that wanted a godly nation, that wanted peace, that wanted their homes restored, that wanted just their house. I just want to plow my field. I just want to be able to keep my sheep, my oxen. I just want to move on. That's all. But here they find themselves, but 22,000 of it, when they found themselves coming to face with the enemy. They said, I got to go. I'm out of here. I'm done. You know, fear can be contagious, panic. And you know, the thing is that here, fear is an interesting thing. You know, I'll be very honest with you. I'm probably more fearful, humanly speaking, now than I've ever been in my lifetime. Quite honest. I'm afraid for the world. Like more than ever. I can remember as a little kid, you know, when we had on Friday mornings, the sirens would go off and, you know, we all jumped under our desk. People had, you know, bomb shelters at home because we were sure that the Soviet Union was going to attack. And every Friday morning, some of you are old enough, you know, remember that. You know, I mean, the world would, but you know, now I'm more afraid for the world than ever was then. I'm afraid for war. I'm afraid for our country. Afraid for our state. I'm afraid for my children. I'm afraid for my 13 grandchildren and my 4 great-grandchildren. You know, and with that. But, so there, to me, though, there's nothing wrong with fear. It's human. But the thing with Gideon about him, and he had his fears, but Gideon feared God more than he feared man. That was all the difference in the world. Gideon feared they're missing God's plan for his life. Gideon feared he would fail. We're only in this life for one shot. That's it. We're here and then it's over. And here, but the difference between somebody just running home and a mighty man of valor is somebody that they look and say, God, I see it all. Humanly, naturally, it's quite frightening. But I fear you more. I fear not being in your will. I fear not responding to what you have me alive for. I fear missing your plan for me. That's the difference between a mighty man of valor. And so now 22,000 go home. You're now left with 10,000. And the Lord looks at him. He's outnumbered 12 to 1. And now God says, you know, there's still too many. What? Beg your pardon. Yeah. Now I want you to take them down to the river. I want to let them get, they all need, so they're thirsty. They need some rest. They need unwind. I want you to take them down. They need refreshing. And I want you to go down and let them all get a drink of water. And then I want you to observe them all when they drink the water. Now, and then I want you to separate them one from another. And then he tells them, when they go down, he says, now all the ones that are just laying in it, basically, the ones that are just laying in it, drinking it up, set them in one group. And the ones that are kind of lapping, the ones that are looking around, the ones that, you know, that now, I mean, that are, where's the enemy? Where are the Midianites? The ones that are there, I want you to separate them. So he's got 9,700 laying in it, 300 doing this. Well, I hate to lose 300, but let's go with the 9,700 probably. No, it's close, but not quite. It's the 9,700. Tell them to go home. We'll go with the 300. And you wonder, what is this about? You know, and the interesting thing, they all needed refreshing. They all needed their water. That was unanimous. But some people can spend all of their energy and effort on unnecessary things. They almost have a vacation mentality in the middle of a war zone. But 300 of them are ready to go to war. 300 of them are looking around waiting for the enemy. And they're postured different. And to me, God looks and says, there's your people. Tell the 9,700, thank you very much. You may go home. And then he's got 300 left. And now Gideon tells him, okay, here's the plan. All of you, you're going to get a pot. And then you're going to get there are torches that you're going to have there in the pot and a trumpet. And then we're going to have three groups. One group here, here, and here, and all around them. You're going to spread out, and then at night, when the darkest hour, when I'm going to blow a trumpet and give the signal, when you hear that, then all of you break the pot, take out the torch, blow the trumpet, shout, the sword of the Lord and the sword of Gideon. And he says, then stand your ground. Here, the Lord, what an interesting thing. Here now, these ones that have been whittled and whittled and whittled down to 300. There is the, you know, they end up with this. And now we're just a clay pot. We're just human beings. But if you're a child of God, you've got a flame inside. There's a light inside of you, a torch. And here he says, I want you to go up in your brokenness. You've already given your life up. There's 300 against 120,000. You think this is certainly a suicide mission. But it's already a suicide mission. You've given up your life. You've surrendered fully. So you're going to take that pot, what symbolizes you, you're going to take that torch. And when you hear the trumpet, you're going to break that pot, take that torch out. You're going to blow the trumpet, and you're going to shout, the sword of the Lord, the sword of Gideon. And here is the rod in the night, and here are these, all these enemies, all these various groups and nations down there in the valley. All of a sudden there, they hear in the dark of the night, they see these torches all around them. They hear these trumpets blow. It echoes across the valley there, and the sword of the Lord, sword of the Lord, sword of the Lord, Gideon, the Lord, sword of the Lord. And they see, and they look, where did they come from? We're surrounded. And they begin, next thing you know, God turns them on each other. They didn't know, am I a Midianite? Are you Amalekite? Where are you from? What it is? They think they're all the enemy that has now come down to destroy them, and they turn on one another. And all they had to do was just the brokenness of their life, let the light shine, blow the trumpet, the sword of the Lord, and then stand your ground. Sometimes just going home, being and doing what God wants, standing, it takes everything you've got to stand your ground. To go to work in a world like this, you know, and to stand your ground for the cause of Christ while our country, our state, our counties are in chaos. While everybody is going around with what their opinions, what they are, what it is. And you know, when you find out here, you know, and again, and you, they let the light shine. But the thing is that then, you know, the next thing they turn on each other, and they start, you know, fighting and killing one another. Ephraim, the strongest of all of the tribes, shows up in the middle of this. And they rebuke Gideon. Why didn't you go? What do you mean? Why call on us? You know, stuff. We're the warriors here. Instead of Gideon turns, why, you egomaniacs, where were you? You know, when the trumpet blew, where were you? When the, where were, you know? No. Incredibly, he looks at them. He tells them after, he could have said, don't give me that. He said, you know, you're right. You guys are the warriors. You guys are, he says, you're greater than Manasseh. Well, I'm just a Manasseh from Manasseh. You guys, man, so glad you're, he could include them in. Anybody else that came along with, instead of coming back at them, and the next thing you know, they all come together and they chase them down. They kill 105 of the 120,000. The others are off, but now there is peace that lasts. They can't build their numbers for many, many years. But when you look at this, you know, fear, I get it. The apostles were afraid. They, you know, the breathing of the enemy. But they gathered together and they prayed for boldness. God, give us boldness. We've got a job to do. This is why we're alive. And we're going to do it one way or the other. And you know, I think one of the most wonderful things that ever happens in somebody's life is when they've got a call on their life and they realize, I'm the least of the least of the least. But I do have a home. I do have a little bit of territory that needs repairing. God, send me home. God, in my neighborhood. God, at the office, help me just to break that vessel. Let the light out, blow the trumpet. Say the sword of the Lord Jesus is the hope of the world. It isn't, you know, Putin. It isn't our president, whoever it may or may not be. It isn't going to be our Congress. It isn't going to be for one side to get dominance, one political party to take control. It isn't going to, this is nothing compared to the real eternal issue of men's souls. And when we look and realize that is why I am alive. Amen.